Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this storm-tossed, star-crossed, corona-kissed edition, we'll spend a little time in the sonic world of Barry Adamson, the man whose career began playing bass on the Manchester post-punk scene, but ended up in the world of film music. We'll be down on the sustainable colour farm in Clashin with eco-artist Nicola Brown, and Maurice Gohan will tell us why it is that she has such an unexpectedly rosy view of Valentine's Day. But we begin with that Moss Side story. When Barry Adamson wanted to move on from his role as a bass player with bands such as Magazine and the Bad Seeds, his solution was to create a soundtrack for a film that didn't exist, Moss Side Story. It worked, and since then he's created a huge body of work in film music, as well as teaming up with a who's who of slender, arty rockers. Adamson has recently been working on the new film from the English David Lynch, Peter Strickland, but that's no surprise, because he'd already worked with the American David Lynch. The surprise was that his role in Strickland's In Fabric was as an actor. Adamson is coming to Dublin this month to play a live soundtrack to the silent classic The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and ahead of that he spoke to Culturefile about bass love, working with difficult frontmen, and sound pictures.
This is Barry Adamson, and there isn't really a line that sums me up. I honestly think it started in the womb. I looked on the charts to see what was going on around my birth, and it's like some of the things are still my favourite records. Fever by Peggy Lee. As soon as that bass sort of steps in, it soothes me, you know?
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care.
I think around the sort of 8-9 month mark before I was born, that was played constantly at home. So I had a very rich world of music going on around me, I think. One of the bass line that did always sort of hit me between the eyes was Bootsy Collins playing on Sex Machine when he was about 17, I think.
One, two, three, four!
And I used to listen to that, and some of my dad's jazz records as well, you know. I very quickly sort of became a sort of bass-playing aficionado on who does what, you know, overnight. I found my way around it quite quickly, still not to a great sort of dexterity, but enough to sort of be able to move people and give the feeling and that sort of stuff was quite a revelation to me. So I sought that out in other players, really.
Fingers start shaking.
As well, there's a kind of requirement from your own sort of persona to make some kind of mark within what's going on, to contribute, you know. But I found the demands of each band quite different, really. In some senses, the Bad Seeds required less dexterity than Magazine, where Magazine there seemed to be a sort of a playing sort of competence amongst everyone that was sort of far beyond me. Whereas in the Bad Seeds, there was more of a punk ethic, if you like, to not really learning things and just making them happen. You know, I always remember Roland Howard sort of saying, like, you know, well, wonder what it'd be like if I did learn to play this thing.
And the rain came hammering down.
Everybody running for their wagons.
It's kind of horses for courses in some ways, and you sort of fashion what you do around what's going on, and hopefully, you know, that sort of brings out something great in what's going on.
The whole valley reeks of wet beast and rotten sun.
It's part of the art and part of whatever it is that a singer and a wordsmith, if you like, are trying to get at their art, and you're trying to facilitate them getting at that. That's why they're the front person. For want of a better word, difficulties come with the terrain, you know, and you just got to know when to sort of duck when the punch is coming your way. really, and sort of sidestep and be fairly adroit and nimble on your feet. That's the thing. I was looking for a way to write film music and was told that you can't write film music unless you've written film music. So I was sort of stuck in this catch-22. So I guess the Moss Side Story soundtrack album was a sort of pretense that this was a film anyway. And it was in my mind. So I just happily sort of scored it away, you know. And then that gave me a sort of, well, what have you scored? And I was able to say, well, I've scored this. And this is the kind of, it's also, it worked in another way because it was also the, of the time anyway, the sort of style that I was pretty much, and have remained to a certain degree interested in, which is a sort of darkish, noirish, thrillerish, you know, supernatural, horror-y elements, you know, and that's the way I got in, really. And that did lead indirectly to David Lynch, because David Lynch heard that record and then called me up and said, I've just been listening to your work for 10 hours straight, and I'd like you to work on a film of mine. So, you know, it wasn't wasted. I really enjoyed working on In Fabric. A Peter Strickland movie comes out and you take note. You don't go like, okay, there's this other movie coming out. I've always been a great fan of his. So I was a little bit like, oh my God. I mean, you know, I'm not an actor. I actually found it quite difficult to do, because a lot of the roles in that film are quite animated and you have to sort of act with quotation marks around it. And I'm saying, well, it's going like, just say the lines. You know, and I'm like, right. And it sort of, it undid me a little bit. I kind of found it quite sort of strange, because it was like I was talking just as a sort of, you know, like I would do, like I'm talking to you now, but there were these words that I had to say written slightly different in a slightly kind of strange language, ever so. And it was hard to remember. There was like these little strange inflections, and I thought, they're really important. I've got to get them, you know. And I was working with you know, a great actress, you know, and who was sort of like, for her, it was just like another day, like, well, yeah. And I was like going, like, I'd find myself going, get it right, 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 get it right. So that where I'm used to being in the studio and kind of going, right, okay, here we go. This is what we're going to do. This is going to be, you know. So it's quite good to be that much out of my comfort zone. But then it was nice to get feedback from the other people in the cast, and Peter as well, going, that was great, that was really good, you know, and wow, that was really good, you were really vulnerable, how did you do that? And I was going, oh, shitting it. That was it, really.
Barry Adamson there, and you can catch him along with Adrian Crowley, Sean McCarolyn and Matthew Nolan playing a live soundtrack to The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in Dublin on February 26th. Tickets from tickets.ie. When trendspotter Lee Adelcourt was asked to share what she could spot coming down the line for the 2020s, she predicted the world was about to undergo a rethink of colour. The zingy chemical hues we'd been chasing since we left Woad behind were about to start fading from fashion, to be replaced by subdued and melancholic shades made solely from things grown in forests and fields. Our guest this time, Nicole Brown, was way ahead of Adelcourt. She's spent recent years making over a farm in County Carlow to produce everything she needs to make dyes and inks, and teaches others to do the same. Culturefile's Áine Gallagher went foraging for colour.
Well, it's taken, you know, a while to get it exactly how I wanted. It's still not, like, there's always work to do with the house. 2 weeks ago, I had a problem when a section...
Originally, it's an old farmhouse. It was traditional vernacular architecture, two up, two down. Not small, but not large at all. And there was 33 acres with the plot. And actually the man next door who I bought it from, his family bought it in 1933. It had no electricity, no water. I started from scratch. I stripped it out with a hammer and chisel. My name is Nicola Brown, and I live in a very rural area on the Carlow-Kilkenny-Wexford border. So the town's land would be Ballybrack. It's near Ballymurphy, and I'm surrounded by the Blackstairs Mountains to the front and the side of me. Last year, I decided to take the plunge and put a bigger building outside. So it's a wooden shed that I've insulated with sheep's wool, because I try and be sustainable with everything. And last summer, I planted up five large borders around it with plants specifically for printing and dyeing. And I also had planted in 2009, I'd planted 13,500 trees on the property. Some of them succumbed, the bulk of them succumbed to the ash dieback disease. So I was in a lucky position that 2 years ago I was able to then replant. So I have approximately 13,500 trees suited to my work. So everything that I do, I can get all the raw materials for the studio on my property, which is fantastic.
I assume one of the things that's difficult in textiles is when working with sustainable materials and ingredients, that getting the vibrancy of the colours might be difficult.
Well, I suppose it really depends what area of textiles you're working in. Primarily, I'm doing a technique called eco-printing now. So following on from being a felt maker, once I was introduced to this technique, it's where you're using leaves, onion skins, bark, natural vegetation to make a direct contact print on the fabric. So natural dyeing, which I also do, would be where you make a dye bath of colour and you just colour your fabric in an even colour. Let's just say if you're dyeing with something like comfrey, it could be a greenish background. But with the printing, you're getting a print from the leaves. And you don't get a vibrant colour unless you're using aluminium or ferrous sulfate, sort of metal salts, to help fix the colour. So primarily I work in an environmentally friendly fashion without using any powdered chemicals or powdered metal salts. So the majority of my work, they're more subtle colours. So lots of golds, rusts, they would come from things like onion skins, and then blackberry leaves give a wonderful inky purple. But it's very seasonal.
Great. Will we take a walk around?
Absolutely. Okay. Yep. Now, have you got wellies?
I have boots with me.
Okay, your feet might get wet.
No, anyway. It's fine.
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, I don't mind. We'll go up to the studio first.
Now, I haven't had a chance to clean it since the workshop on Saturday. These are all the dye beds. Plants are just springing up for the, you know, the spring. And then I'm doing this bit here this year.
And on these dye beds, what kind of plants are we looking at?
What we're actually looking right here, like these are Coreopsis.
Okay.
So the Coreopsis is something that I need to use tannin and iron to actually get a reaction with the fabric, because I'm not using the traditional mordant for 95% of my work. The mordant is what makes the colour fix on the fabric. So what I like to do is make up tannin myself. So I would use things like pomegranate rind, or you can get an oak gall tannin. So that would be grinding the material, soaking it in a bucket of water, grinding the natural plant material. And then I would soak the fabric in that, lay my flowers and my leaves on top of it. And I would then wrap them with fabric that had been soaked in rusty water as well. And there's a chemical reaction between the iron from the rust and the tannin from the plant. And that causes a reaction and also gives a background color. So this is Coreopsis. I've got different varieties of Coreopsis. Then here we have comfrey. And then up here we have Himalayan indigo, which I haven't used yet. So it's looking very sort of sad at the moment. It's just winter. Yeah, Himalayan indigo. And so I have a selection of plants here. Yarrow. There actually are 75 different varieties of plants in these borders. So further down there would be peonies, different types of peonies, and sumac, which, again, the leaves give a fantastic print, but at the moment you can't see anything. It just looks like a kind of a shrubby stick. But if you look around to the side here, where if I look out the door of my garden studio, these trees in front of us are actually a selection of quite a few different varieties of eucalyptus. So the eucalypts give fantastic prints and what's called substantive colour. That means colour that won't wash out on fabric. particularly things that are protein-based. So that's something that comes from an animal. So silk, wool, cashmere, yak, civet, all those sorts of fabrics that come, you know, initially from an animal. So some of these trees here, the tallest trees, have only been planted 3 years, and they're absolutely incredibly tall. I now am in the position that I'm looking for varieties with interesting leaf shapes, and the juvenile leaf, if we actually look at this tree here, the young leaf in most eucalypts is a totally different shape from the older leaf. So this one here, it's got a round leaf that's actually fused at the base when it's young. And then as the plant matures, the leaves get much longer and they're not opposite each other anymore.
And then the studio is nestled away in front of
The studio to be as, you know, to sit in the environment as much as possible. And it's made from timber. I actually had it made in Fingal in Dublin. I was delighted. It took me a long time to find an Irish manufacturer that would make something that was... you're smelling the eucalyptus from my workshop at the weekend. Yeah. So when it came, it had a membrane inside it. And then my friend who helps me outside and does some building type things, he lined the whole of the studio, including the roof. He lined it all with wool. So it's got wool insulation. Then it was slabbed up and I painted it. And it's fantastic. I made a conscious decision not to pipe water up and not to put lights in. So I work, you know, with the daylight at the moment. If I'm actually teaching, I work from 9:30 until about 4:15, 4:30. But in the summer, obviously, I can work much later.
What implements do you need to use to transfer the patterns from the plants onto the fabrics?
It's extremely simple. So the first thing when I'm teaching, you know, the fabric has to be very well washed. So you can just wash that by hand. And I like to use a gentle olive oil soap or a handmade soap. You're not looking to have something with stain blasters in it, basically, that's going to prevent you adding the stain from the plant onto your piece of fabric. Then you just lay your fabric on the table. Put your leaves on top.
This fabric, sorry, would be pre-dyed?
No. This fabric would have no colour whatsoever.
Okay, it's taking the colour and the pattern from the...
So it's taking the colour from the natural materials. Within the textile, you know, the eco-printing community, I suppose, worldwide, I would be known for something which everybody is now terming a dirty pot. And that basically is a large pot. For a lot of my work, I work with aluminium. So instead of working with the mordant, as in the metallic salt, which would be a chemical that you would be adding to your fabric or preparing your fabric, I'm using the chemical property of the pot to slightly mimic what the actual powder would do. So I work primarily with aluminium, but also cast iron. We might have a walk down if you'd like to see my biggest pot. I brought it back from France. It was used for cooking vegetables on a farm, and it's 240 litres. So this is my biggest pot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this pot here was a fantastic find at a brocante in France. And when I saw this pot, I nearly expired with excitement because I'd been looking for a really big pot in Ireland and not been successful. So this is cast iron construction and it's sitting in a galvanized steel outer holder. And at the bottom here, there's a little door. And so it's wood fired. I use timber for my own tree. So I heat it up with wood and there's a chimney at the back. The results that come out of this pot are absolutely superb. The cast iron gives very dramatic colour. So you can see that the liquid that's in there looks very inky now. And because the pot is so big, you'd think it would take a very long time to come to boil. But about 17 minutes, I timed it. And it's a bit like a jacuzzi. It bubbles away. It's like a witch's cauldron. But it's fantastic. So this year, for the first time, I'm actually intending on doing workshops during the summer where we will be using this pot. Up to now, I've reserved it for myself and very special friends who visit. But I think it's captured the imagination of quite a few people when I've put videos of the process online, so I'm thinking of doing workshops and letting some other people enjoy it as well. When I moved here at the beginning, I wasn't involved in any textiles whatsoever. So when I actually came here, I had been involved in helping organize sustainable events, and I was actually studying interior design. And I then, through the sustainable events, I became interested in felt making. So in fact, I never looked back. From then on, I was addicted to textiles. So I suppose before it really became a buzzword, I was always interested in living a more sustainable life. But it was just a lifestyle choice. You know, my parents always believed you bought quality.
Do you think there's a dangerous aspect of it being used in a buzzword way?
Yes. And I also think, like, if you go to any of the chain stores now, you know, there's so many products such as bamboo socks and products that are considered natural, but they are man-made. They're made from pulp. But there's a big danger. There's huge pollution caused with some of those natural fabrics, and people are sort of jumping on the bandwagon and feeling good because they're wearing certain things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are actually good for the environment.
Difficult, I think, sometimes to find clothes that are both sustainable but also decorative, or kind of fulfill that aesthetic want that people look for when they buy an item of clothing.
I am conscious that I'm not a fashion, you know, it's not a fashion brand. I'm not producing fashion. It just happens that everything to do with nature and the environment is sort of like a buzz type thing at the moment. And cotton is one of the biggest environmental polluters. There's huge, awful things with pesticides, etc., in the production of cotton. But if you're buying things that are organic, and I do understand people don't have so much money, if you're buying inexpensive, really, really inexpensive clothes, they just wear out very quickly and they shrink, the seams come apart. You're much better actually buying good quality secondhand, or waiting a little bit, maybe not smoking, not having a drink, and investing in a quality product.
Nicola Brown in her studio at Clashine, and the reporter was Áine Gallagher. And follow Culturefile on Instagram, another one, to see photos from that visit. And finally this week, Valentine's Day, that high feast of anonymous cards, somewhat creepy, and Insta-ready grand romantic gestures. Deeply creepy. But comedian Maurice Gohan is absolutely not one of those soulless killjoys who calls out the Hallmark holiday. No, sirree, she loves love, as she's going to explain.
It is the week of St. Valentine. Cupid is aiming his bow all around town. One time as a kid, I sent an anonymous Valentine's Day card to myself. I was maybe 10, 11 years old. I bought a stamp, put it in the post box, acted surprised when it came in the door. My parents were less surprised. They recognized the handwriting. My point being, this is my holiday. I love love. People assume I'm cynical because of my demeanor and obsession with death and general bad attitude. And they would be correct. For the most part, I'm very miserable, but not with love. I'm a big ol' fan. I love all the facets of it. Rom-coms, for example, are an art form. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days should have won an Oscar. You're going to praise Matthew McConaughey for his performance in Dallas Buyers Club? That didn't take a good actor. Anyone could have done that. But his nuanced take on a playboy who falls in love with Kate Hudson? That is skill. The denouement of the film, when they both find out the other one has been playing them, and McConaughey says, "Congratulations, you've lost me." And Kate Hudson responds with pitch-perfect poignancy, "You can't lose something you never had." Ugh, that is the crux of human experience right there. That is the beginning and end of everything. My personal journey with love has been at times rocky. I've been in love 4 times, and for 3 of those, so 75% of my love experience, I've just felt a bit tricked by the whole thing. Because I've fallen in love straight off the bat, just balls to the wall. I go all in very, very early, way too early. And then I get to know the person I've fallen in love with, and I don't like what I learn. So I just wake up 6 months in, look over the other side of the bed, and I think, you are a repulsive human being. I don't agree with any of your beliefs or ways of conduct or passions, but I love you, goddammit. So love has always felt like a bit of a prison. you stick yourself to someone and then you find out who they really are and then you get a bit sick in your mouth. Rinse and repeat. But I still believed in the fairy tale for my sins. I have a boyfriend now and he's the one. Yeah, he's my Kate Hudson. Naturally, I'm McConaughey, so he has to be Kate. I would be very surprised if I don't marry him and have his children. For legal reasons, I should disclose we've been together for 2 months. What's the secret to our loving and long-lasting relationship? Number one, we were very good friends before we fell in love. We even lived together for a bit, so I just knew who he was. For example, I knew he ate a fry every single morning. Quite excessive. Nobody should be consuming that many sausages. I knew he screamed when in the shower because he used to be taking them cold for some reason. I knew he was a generous lover because one time I accidentally walked in on him with a woman. Number two, we are each other's biggest fans. We think the other is the bee's knees. He's a comedian too, and I'm his best audience. Everything he says, I find funny. Even if I don't get it, I'm still laughing. Even if it's something serious, like him finding out his aunt had cancer, I'm just ha 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 ha, always laughing, always giving him his due, shouting encore. That's it, really. I knew who he was and I liked who he was. Again, for legal reasons, I have to mention we've been going out for just 8 weeks. But I'm the happiest I've ever been. If love is a prison, lock me up, officer. Throw away the keys. I guess that's what marriage is, just throwing away the keys. Or handing the keys to the government and saying, hide these, don't tell me where. If you're in a relationship right now and when you look at them, maybe you're looking at them right now, at the back of their stupid heads, and you just feel a mix of disgust and dread. You just feel the bile rising up in your throat. Dump them right now. Call them up. Here, use my phone. Say we need to talk. Get rid. Life is too short. Go out with my boyfriend instead.
Maurice Gohan there on What's Not to Like About Valentines, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more unexpected oxytocin surges next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.